You're welcome. Mac from Canada.
Hi, everybody. I'm Mac Cheater. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Mac.
I just can't thank the committee enough for inviting me here this weekend. This is the last effort I have to participate in this year, I hope. This is the last one, and I just couldn't have been more privileged than to share in this weekend the last job to do this year, and it's just been a beautiful experience, and it's just like a holiday. I'm going to go home just all filled up, and I've really been thrilled to be with Wade and Judy and all of the committee and many of you people, and I thank you sincerely. I want to also thank the speakers that have spoken before me. Although you've made my job very difficult, you've given me much. And I'm looking forward to our speaker in the morning. I'm an alcoholic, and all I can do is share my experience, strength, and hope with you. And perhaps something I might say might help somebody here tonight. I like to remind myself and those I speak to that alcoholism is a terrible, terrible, incurable, fatal illness, that more people will die in the state of North Carolina from alcoholism in the next 12 months than any other single illness, that alcoholism in North America today is in epidemic proportions, that it is not getting better, it's getting worse, that society seems to be weakening and accepting things and instead of doing something about it. And I know that that's not our concern. We're not in the alcoholism business, but those are the facts. And those of us that walk in this society free from the compulsion to drink are truly blessed people. Those of us who can participate in a weekend like this are truly blessed individuals. And I have to keep saying that for my own sake. We have a company in Canada that makes booze, Seagram's. Some of you people buy a little of that. Or have bought it. Canadian Club, and I see the signs around. They've just done a great thing. They've contributed just under $6 million to one of your minor colleges. I think it's Harvard, the medical school there. And they're going to use that money in research. They're going to try to find out why alcohol affects some people different than others. I've offered to give them that information for half the price. Save all that trouble. But alcoholism does affect some people different than others. And I happen to be a person who suffers from a fatal malady called alcoholism, and it does affect me different than others. Alcohol does, because I happen to have that illness. And many people think you get alcoholism by drinking booze, but I don't believe that. I think that you're alcoholic and you drink booze because you are alcoholic. And I think that's important to remember, because some of us get into Alcoholics Anonymous and we get so dry and so pious in our sobriety that we forget that alcoholics drink booze. And we sit in our groups and we get all upset if somebody goes out and has slipped. And we say, my God, I wonder what happened to him. You know, he drank. And I like to think that alcoholics drink booze. And he drank because he's alcoholic, or she drank because she's alcoholic. It's no big deal. Just when life gets too much for the alcoholic and they're doing things on their own, they get drunk. I did that thousands of times before I got here. I like to think I had all my slips before I got here. I haven't had to have a drink or any kind of a pill since the 12th of March, 1956. And that is no credit to me. It just is the way it happened. But I happen to belong to a group called the Golden Slippers. And that group is made up of people that have trouble staying sober. And by golly, it's something else. Because all of a sudden it's starting to work. And I like to mention that group because it got started one night. A guy I had been calling on for many years. His name was Cliff. And Cliff was an interesting sort of a drunk. He always used to commit suicide with a shotgun. And I don't know whether you've ever watched anybody committing suicide with a shotgun, but anybody in the room's got a hell of a lot better chance of dying than the guy with a shotgun. And it used to be exciting to go and see Cliff because he always had that shotgun he waving around, and that was the first thing he had to do was get the shotgun away from him. And anyway, old Cliff, I watched him. He drank himself out of a job and out of a home, and he lost his family, and he wound up in very dire circumstances, and every year it seemed to get worse. And one night, Saturday night, Cliff phoned me, and he said, "Mac, I'm sorry to bother you on a Saturday night, but I've called everybody else I know. Nobody will come and see me, and I really need help." So I had talked to another guy just the night before, old Ross. Ross the same way. Ross never missed too many meetings, but he just kept on drinking. And it got so his group wouldn't pay much attention to him. He kind of felt on the outside, like maybe as an afterthought, the chairman would say, "Ross, if you got anything to say tonight," and it didn't matter what he said, nobody paid attention to him. And he kind of felt this, and he thought that if I paid some special attention to him, he could get sober. And so I phoned old Ross up and said, "Come on, Ross, we've got a 12-step call. We've got to go and see Cliff." Well, Cliff always had lots of booze around, and so Ross, when I was pontificating, he got into Cliff's booze, and he had a few drinks, and they listened, and I just ate that up, you know. They were a good audience, and they convinced me that we should have breakfast the next morning at my expense, and I went along with that. I'm sober. They're drunk. I went along with it, and I got up early the next morning, went and met them, and they showed up, and they told me their story, that nobody would pay attention to them. If they just had somebody like me that would sponsor them and take them through the steps, they wouldn't have any trouble. And I went right along with it. I said, "Fine, you get a place and we'll have a meeting, and special meeting." They didn't want anybody else to be there. They said, if anybody else shows up, we'll just be on the outside again. So they decided that 7 o'clock Sunday morning would be a good time. Well, I talked him down a little, and we started off, I think we started at 8. We now meet at 9. And they kept right on drinking, and we had our meetings, and pretty soon we had a little group going, and they wanted to call it a group. Well, the Golden Slippers seemed like a good name for them, and so they registered the group. Well, I made Ross the secretary. His wife phoned me up and said, "You got to be out of your tree, putting him in charge of the money." And I said to her, "Well, if he's still drinking, I don't know anybody could use money more than him." Well, they kept right on drinking, and Ross finally got sober, and Cliff was about to die. And I was invited to speak at Blue Ridge. And I asked Cliff if he'd come with me. And he did. And he hasn't had a drink since. And I think that's 4 years. Old Cliff and Ross are sober, and they're dull as hell now. They're just no fun. So that group is working. So if there's somebody out here tonight that is having trouble staying sober, if you're a slipper, don't feel bad. Hell, you'll get here sooner or later. You got no other place to go. And we love you. And just keep coming back, and it'll work. And I sponsored a doctor, that was in Alcoholics Anonymous for 23 years and had never made a year. And he just kept coming back. And by God, he got sober. So, never give up. And that's our Golden Slippers group. It's no different than any other group. They just think it's different. I suffer from an illness that I didn't know anything about. I did not know I was an alcoholic until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not know that I was a sick person. I didn't know anything about it. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I found out that in order to be here, you had to be an alcoholic. Now, if you had asked me the day before if I was an alcoholic, I'd have told you I was a social drinker. Now, some guy up in New York has come up with an idea where he can make social drinkers out of alcoholics. I want him to know that social drinking damn near killed me. I would not want to be a social drinker. I was a social drinker until I got here. I got here and I became an alcoholic and haven't had a drink since. I never said I was an alcoholic. As a matter of fact, most people don't. You go into a bar and say, how many alcoholics are in here? There won't be any in there. You try that. You go and say, all the alcoholics stand up. Nobody stands up. All the social drinkers are in there. And that's the way I drank. I was a social drinker. Now that I've got to be an alcoholic and don't drink anymore, I've taken a look at some of those social drinkers. My wife is a social drinker. My wife will drink three drinks on a real big night. And they got a very serious problem, those people. If you just watch them, they take an ounce of whiskey and they put some 7-Up in it, and then they mix it with ice and they sit and suck on it for an hour and a half, and the ice melts, and my God, it's painful to watch them, and they really don't know what they're about. Someday, maybe the world will get around to doing something about social drinkers, because they're much more sicker than alcoholics are. They gotta be, drink that way. They got a very serious problem. And they don't know what's wrong with them. And it's painful to watch them. I came here, found out I was an alcoholic, and I found out that I had a mind and a body that's different than normal. For a long time, I thought that meant I was inferior. I want you to know that it doesn't mean that. I have a mind and a body that is different than normal. And all that means is that it's different. It's not inferior. Now you stop and think about what alcoholics have done to themselves, and you look around the room tonight, there isn't a person here that's an alcoholic should be here. We've done enough, we've abused ourselves enough that we shouldn't even be here. You listen to the stories of what people do to themselves, and they shouldn't be here. And everybody looks like they've never done anything wrong in their lives. They look like they've been pampered all their lives. And they shouldn't even be alive. You just can't be an alcoholic and have a body that's inferior. It's got to be a little better than average. You won't live. You won't make it. As far as the mental goes, we best not discuss that, because sometimes Al-Anons and a few people get an inferiority complex when I explain that part of it. So I just pass that. But you know, we've got a minister here. I imagine he's paid by his congregation to preach on Sunday morning, and he's here. You know, now, I would suspect some of those people in the congregation, they're normal people. They got a little problem. They're paying that preacher, and we got them. You know? So you just see a few examples of that. You know whether we got a mental, whether we're inferior mentally or not. He's convinced them that he had to be here this weekend, and they're paying him, and he's here. And I don't know who's going to preach the service, but he's here. I didn't know I was sick. And you know, when I was a little boy growing up, I used to get earache, and I used to have a little tonsillitis and whatnot, and I'd get to stay home from school, and I could remember how they used to bring my meals up to my room and pamper me and love me all day long. And later on in life, I used to say to myself, God, I wish I could be sick. I wish I could just be sick, because people are nice to people that are sick. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and the first thing you told me, I was sick. The nicest thing I've ever heard in my life. I said to my wife, I'm a sick man. I'm really sick, and you have to be careful with me. I remember telling my banker I was sick. And he agreed with me. And he suggested I ought never come into his bank again. But I wanted to dwell in the illness. I was glad to be sick. I don't know if anybody else felt that way or not, but I was so damn glad to be sick because being sick was an excuse and an alibi for everything that I was. And for a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous, I wanted to dwell in the illness. I wanted to stay sick. And I used it. You know, if I was upset, I'd say, well, I'm an alcoholic, you know. I'm very sensitive. People could offend me, and I could take advantage of my illness. It was an excuse. If I didn't want to go to work, well, I'm not well this morning. You know, I'm sick. Well, if you want to be sick, you can't recover. And this is a program of recovery. Do you know that this is the only program in the world that offers recovery to alcoholics? We can recover from alcoholism in Alcoholics Anonymous. A program of recovery. And even in the definition it says that we share our experience, strength, and hope with each other that we may recover. It is not a program of sobriety. We do not have a legacy of sobriety. We have a legacy of recovery. You can recover from alcoholism in Alcoholics Anonymous. And sometimes we go around very superstitious. We're afraid to say that. I stand up here tonight and tell you I'm a recovered alcoholic, and somebody will be sitting back there saying he shouldn't say that. Well, I'm about as dry as I'm going to get. And I look around the room, some of these old timers that were standing up there, they look like fire hazards, you know. They're so dry. And if you went to a doctor and he treated you and 25 years later you were still recovering, you'd be getting yourself another doctor. And you don't have to wait 25 years to recover in this program. And if you don't agree with that, the program is so beautiful, it gives you an out. Because it says, those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. You just take your pick. Now, there's nothing wrong with being well. I'm a well human being. And the state of well-being is a beautiful state to be in. And if I'm a miserable SOB at times, and I am, I cannot hang that on my alcoholism. I can no longer blame my alcoholism for anything I am. Even though I know I will be an alcoholic until the day I die. Even though I know there's never a cure. But I no longer can use my alcoholism as an excuse for bad living. Because I've been given away. I've been given a program of recovery, and I can no longer hide behind the illness. I have to stand up and be well. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm a well human being, and I enjoy being well. I want to stay well. And I can stay well, I can stay recovered in this program if I live it one day at a time, do the things I'm supposed to do. If I accept the fact that it is a daily program and it is contingent upon my spiritual well-being, I don't have to drink. I do that by choice. You see, nobody can tell me I'm an alcoholic. There's no test I can take. There's no doctor that can give me a test and say, you know, your blood level is such and such, therefore you're alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic because I say I am. And that's all that's necessary. Matter of fact, you don't even have to say you're an alcoholic when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous. Although most of us do automatically. We're kind of adept at telling lies. And I lied for many months. I openly lied. I sat in a meeting and said I was alcoholic. Knew damn well I wasn't, but I just went along. I didn't want to be here. I don't know whether any of you people wanted to be here or not. I didn't. I just didn't get up in the morning and say, I'm going to go join Alcoholics Anonymous today. I came here because I had no place else to go. I didn't know what to do. The day that I phoned for help, I was desperate and I didn't know what else to do. If there was anything else I could have thought of, I probably would have done that first. I had quit drinking many times and just couldn't do it by myself. And that day, I hope to God I never forget it, when I had the phone. Because I wasn't a nice, healthy person. I was a crying, babbling idiot that shouldn't even been allowed to live. And I phoned for help. Never had to take a drink since. Old Cecil came to see me. Some of you people know old Cecil. Last weekend, I went to speak at a place, and this gal came up to me and said, "Are you Mac?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "Oh, I expected a much older person. I expected you'd be as old as Cease." Well, old Cease is a few years younger than I am, but, you know, we keep calling him old Cease, and she had heard a tape, and she thought he was an old man. I phoned him and told him about that. Cease came to see me. Cease and I drank together. And Cease got away and got sober. And I hated him for it because everybody made such a fuss over him, and he was doing so well, and I was still going the other way, and I thought, well, you know, he's a common drunk, and they're all making a big fuss over him, and here I am, they won't pay any attention to me, and I resented Cease the last few years of my drinking, but I phoned him the day I needed help. And I must have been a lead pipe since to get in here, because he came along with 20 questions. And I don't know whether he used those 20 questions here or not, but he asked me to answer some questions. And one of them was, "Did you seek lower companions when you were drinking?" Well, hell, I drank with him. And I couldn't lie my way out of that. Cease and I have traveled many miles together, and never a week has gone by, I don't think, that we haven't talked since I've been in this fellowship. And we live quite a few miles apart, and we spend a lot of money on phone calls. I didn't know what it was to be an alcoholic, and I found out since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I want you to know that I knew a lot about drinking, and I knew a lot about suffering, and knew a lot about dying, but I didn't know anything about alcoholism, and I found out about alcoholism when I came here. I found out that I had a mind that played tricks on me. I found out that because I'm alcoholic, I have a mind that makes me see things that are different than what they are. For instance, I could look right at 20 years of failure and convince myself that this time it was going to be different. I could look right at total hopelessness and convince myself that this time I was only going to take one drink. I could walk into a bar and say, "I'm only going to have one drink and then I'll go home," and never get home for 2 weeks, and yet convince myself that the next time it'll only be one drink. See, I have a mind that I cannot trust. Dottie, Johnny's wife in California, says she has a mind that's out to get her. And that's what I got. I got a mind that's out to get me. Because you see, I have a mind that does things to me that make sense when I'm doing it. And I don't know whether you people were like that or not, but you see, if I went in to have a drink at 5 o'clock to have one drink and was still there at 4 o'clock the next morning, it made sense to be there. You see, if somebody said, "Why did you go home?" I'd say, "Hell, why should I go home? My wife's just as mad at 5 o'clock as she is at 4 o'clock. There's no point in going home." And if I went home and my wife was upset, I'd say, "What are you upset for? I told you last Tuesday I'd be late." Everything I did made sense when I was doing it. I sponsored a little gal, and she had a bad habit. She lit fire to things. And I remember one day I said to her, "What was the worst thing you ever did in your life?" And she said, "I set fire to an apartment block." And I said, "Why did you do that?" And she said, "I don't know, but it made sense at the time." And I said, "I can understand that. But everything I did made sense." I quit drinking one day, and I always quit drinking at the worst times. This day I quit drinking, and we were having a party, a going away party for a very good friend of mine at our house that night. And I quit drinking. And that morning I just knew I'd never take another drink. I just knew I wouldn't. And I made these plans, and all of a sudden I thought of that party. I thought, "My God, what am I going to do? You know, tonight everybody's going to notice. There's just no way I could go to that party and people would know I wasn't drinking and that would be disastrous. And then the old alcoholic mind started to work, and I come up with a tremendous idea. I would just be such a gracious host. I would be so busy serving drinks, and nobody, I'd have glasses sitting all over. They'd never know whether they're drinking or not. I'd pick up a glass and set it over there and ask people if they'd like another drink. And so all of a sudden, I felt relieved. I knew I could get away with that. And about 6 o'clock that night, I had the glasses out, and the ice and the mix and the booze was out, and I was all dressed, and, you know, nobody was coming till about 8:30. And I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden, my wife come out all dressed up. And then she did a terrible thing. She said, "While we're waiting, why don't we have a drink?" And I was trapped. There was no way I could tell her I'd quit drinking. So what did I do? I attacked. I said to her, "My God, woman, do you have to be drinking all the time? You can't even wait for the party to start. All you want to do is drink." She thought I'd gone right out of my mind. About 4 o'clock the next morning, the guests are trying to leave, and I'm at the door saying, "What do you have to go for? What's the hurry? We're just getting started." I always quit drinking at the worst time because I was alcoholic. I had a mind and a body that's different than normal. Had it then, had it, have it today. I don't trust my thinking today. Do you know that I do not rely upon my own thinking today? I start every day off asking God to direct my thinking. I do that because it says so in the big book. When I get up in the morning, I ask God to direct my thinking, especially divorcing it from self-pity, self-seeking, and dishonest motives. And that's how I start my day, because I have a mind that cannot trust. I have a mind that I can't let it go by itself. And if you try to get through the day on your own, you're going to have trouble sooner or later. I found out that alcoholics don't have the obvious kind of a compulsion and craving that we think about. You know, we think about somebody that is a compulsive drinker. We have visions of Ray Milland looking for that bottle he had hidden. And I didn't drink that way. When I drank, I didn't have a compulsion. I just drank. It made sense to drink. I sometimes shook a little, but it made sense. I never recognized it as a great compulsion. I had a great need. You know, it made sense to drink. I didn't see it as a great big deal. I just needed a drink. The fact that it was 7 o'clock in the morning didn't make any difference. There's nothing wrong with drinking in the morning. I never could understand why anybody got upset because you drank in the morning. There's no difference drinking in the morning than, you know, it's night someplace. Somebody says, you're not supposed to drink till night. Well, it's night someplace. I'm not drinking in the morning. It's night. I'm working a different time check. It wasn't until I got here I recognized that compulsion, that it was my mind that was deceiving me. The compulsion was there all the time. I just never recognized it. I didn't want to recognize it. And so I found out another thing, that some people in Alcoholics Anonymous were the kind of drinkers that could pick up a drink without any thought. An alcoholic is a person who can pick up a drink with no thought whatsoever. No thought of the family, no thought of the creditors, no thought of the boss, no thought of anything. Just pick up a drink and drink it. And so if you have an alcoholic in your family who has promised not to drink and they drink, don't get upset with them, because maybe they didn't even think about it. They just drank. But what happens when an alcoholic picks up a drink? First thing you say to yourself is, "I had one, I might as well get drunk." You might say, "How did this get started?" But pretty soon you say, "Well, this will be the last drunk. I might as well make it a good one." You never think of stopping. And you can't help yourself. There's just no way that you can help yourself. One of the things I had to learn was the total helplessness, the total hopelessness. I cannot stay sober by myself. I came to you people and you told me that I had to find a spiritual way of life. You told me that I had to come to believe in some power greater than myself. I want you to know I never denied the existence of God until I got here. And I found out when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that alcoholics had trouble with God, and I had trouble with God. I made it all up. I sat in a meeting and told people I just couldn't believe in all this God business. I never did that in my life before until I got here. But it made me the center of attraction again for about two meetings. Everybody tried to help me, and I felt good. I was the most important person in the room when I said I was having trouble with God. And then those old-timers said, go away, believe whatever the hell you want to believe. They realized I was conning them. Alcohol and God doesn't mix. It's just something incompatible about God and being drunk. And so when I was drinking, I tried to put all those teachings that I was taught as a boy and all of the things that I knew were right, I tried to put those out of my mind and pretend that they didn't matter anymore, that our society had changed and it wasn't important, and that those old people, you know, it was all right for them to believe, but it wasn't important anymore. I look back on a childhood that there was just no way that I could find anything in my upbringing, in my childhood, that would lead me to think that I had any reason to be alcoholic. I was brought up in a loving Christian home. Joe Lee says good Christian homes are just breeding grounds for alcoholics, because every alcoholic gets up says I was brought up in a good Christian home. But I was taught everything that you should be taught as a child. I had love and understanding, compassion. I don't ever remember anybody being mean to me. I don't ever remember anybody doing anything to me in a fit of temper. And I just had, even in when I drank, I can't ever remember anybody in my family saying anything bad to me. Mind you, I moved away. I lived away for 20 years, and I don't ever recall them phoning me and saying, come home, either. But I came from a good family and was well taken care of, no reason at all to be what I was. And I knew it was wrong. I used to sit in church on a Sunday morning and that preacher used to preach right at me. I can remember thinking, why don't you talk to the rest of the people? Why talk on me? I'm not as bad as I look. I'm not what you think I am. I remember getting drunk one afternoon and walking over to the preacher's house. Well, we came to a parting of the ways. He told me I was nothing but a pagan. I told him a few things, too. And we got to be friends again after I got sober, but you know, I knew it was wrong to do what I was doing. And I wasn't comfortable doing it. And when I came to you people, and you talked to me about a spiritual way of life, I thought, oh goodness, I got to go through all that again. And I had so much guilt, and I fought it. Well, one of the beautiful things about Alcoholics Anonymous is that we don't have to worry about what God is, or where He is, or how He works. You know? This program is so constructed that it makes our belief so easy. As a matter of fact, we don't even have to believe. Do you know that? In the beginning it says all we have to do is be willing to believe. And if we just pretend, if we just act as though, and if you can't act, you shouldn't be here. Every alcoholic can act. God, you got to act to survive. You know, every alcoholic has to be an accomplished actor. Ever get out of jail in the morning and go to work? Somebody say, how was your weekend? Oh, great. You know, had a beautiful time. And you hope God, I hope they don't put it in the paper. Every alcoholic can act. We acted all our lives. When I used to sit and I could be anything I wanted to be. I used to be able to daydream. I could be whatever I wanted to be anytime I wanted to be it. And I found out that in Alcoholics Anonymous, all I had to do was to be willing to believe, to act as though. And I could do that. They make it real tough for us. Act as though you believe. Sam Shoemaker said, if you try the God experiment, 6 months later, you might still be arguing about the experiment, but you cannot deny the experience. And that's what happened to me. I went to my old sponsor and said, Cecil, there's an awful lot of God business in Alcoholics Anonymous. They're Bible thumpers. And he looked at me and said, how long have you been sober? And I told him it had been a few days, a few weeks, hadn't been very long. And he said to me, how many years has it been since you've gone that long without a drink, without one drink? And I honestly could not remember how many years it had been since I'd gone that long without at least one drink. And then he said to me, do you think you've done that all by yourself? And I knew I had not done that by myself. I knew that I did not have the power within me to do that because I had tried so many countless times that I could not go without a drink that long. Something was happening in my life. I was experiencing something I could not deny. I was experiencing sobriety that was beyond my ability, beyond my capability. Something was working. I couldn't deny it. I could argue all I wanted about what was doing it. I could argue about the experiment, but I couldn't deny the experience. And we talk about a spiritual experience. We simply experience things in our lives that make us think, feel, and act and do different than we did before. People say to me, I never heard bells ringing. Well, I don't know many people that did. Bill never did. Read Bill's experience in the big book. He didn't hear bells ringing. He just felt different. He said, I felt as though a wind was blowing through. A spirit. You feel different. You can't come to Alcoholics Anonymous and do the things you're asked to do and not feel different. You can't deny it. And of course, the book makes it so easy. It says things like, either God is or he isn't. Now, how do you ever sit around talking about an isn't? I was an intellectual alcoholic. I certainly didn't discuss isn'ts. We discussed international affairs when I drank. We didn't even discuss local things. They were beneath us. We talked about important issues. We could talk about religion. I could be a Catholic if the other guy was a Protestant. I found out there was just no point in being the same thing. You can't have a decent discussion if you both agree. So, if you wanted to talk politics, the first thing you said, what are you? And then you were something different. And you had a good discussion. You can't talk about an isn't. No alcoholic ever sat around talking about an isn't. God either is or he isn't. And then it says he's either everything or nothing. How can you talk about a nothing? And if he's everything, he's everything. If you want to see him, just look around. Everything is everything. Now, you can't make it any simpler than that. God is everything. If you want to see God, look in the eyes of a sober alcoholic. Go and look in the eyes of a child whose father or mother joined Alcoholics Anonymous. Last Saturday night, I sat at a banquet like this, and I sat beside a little gal in Al-Anon, and she told me about what it was like when her alcoholic was drinking, and I said to her, what's it like today? And her whole face changed. She just lit up, and she told me what it was like. And you see, you can't look at that and not see God. I had a friend who, poor old Frankie, had trouble getting sober. He was one of the people, he used to describe it this way. He said, sometimes when you're playing golf, you take a long approach, and sometimes you take a short approach. He said, I just have to take a long approach. Frank kept coming to meetings, kept drinking. And one day, Frank got sober.
sometime after that, we'd say to Frank, Frank, how long have you been sober now? And he'd say, it doesn't make any difference. I'm sober. Frank died of cancer. He died a terrible death. Frank never looked back. He never complained. One day after Frank got, he was a lawyer, one day he got to be successful again, and he's walking down the street. The doctor stopped him on the street, and the doctor said to him, Frank, do you mind if I ask you a question? And Frank said, well, I don't mind. I hope I can answer it for you. And he said, Frank, how come you're so happy? Frank said, doctors, I stand here and I look around. Every piece of property I see belongs to you. And he said, right now, I don't even have the proverbial pot. What makes you think I'm happy? And the doctor said, Frank, I can see it in your eyes. If you have trouble with God, go look in the eyes. Go talk to a mother, grandmother, child. We're in the people business, you know. We're in the mother business, the father business, the grandmother business. I know there's some mothers and fathers here. I don't argue with God anymore. I don't try to find him anymore. I just let him know I'm here. And I try to talk to him. For a long time, I used to get up in the morning and tell God what I wanted him to do. Did you ever do that? Did you ever get up in the morning and say, God, here's what I want you to do today. I want you to keep me sober. I want you to keep my creditors off my back. I want you to keep my wife off my back. I want you to keep my boss quiet. That never worked. Now I like to get up in the morning and say, God, what have you got for me to do today? I'd like to do some little thing today. And some days it might not be any more than just smiling at somebody. Someday it might not be any more than just sticking out my hand and shaking hands with somebody. Doesn't have to be a big deal. You know, when I was drinking, I always wanted to do big things. I was always going to be the most charitable person in the world after I got rich. I was going to give to the poor like you wouldn't believe after I had enough for myself. Never got around to giving anybody anything because I never had enough. But I meant well. Well, now I can give. And I can give, and all I have to do in the morning is ask God what he wants me to do. Offer myself in service. On the program, it says our real purpose now is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God knows about us. And that doesn't mean we run around taking over committees. It just means that we do the things we're supposed to do to get fit. We fit ourselves. We prepare ourselves, and when God wants us to do something, if we're ready, he'll put us to work. I used to run around trying to do things. Never got anywhere. Then I had to stop and get fit, and I'm still getting fit. And when I'm fit, I get things to do, like old cliff bones, things like that. I've had a fantastic experience in Alcoholics Anonymous that goes on day after day. Wade told you that I had the privilege of serving on the Board of Trustees, and during that time I was chosen to be a member of the World Service Meeting. And that doesn't mean that I'm in it. Let me tell you how I got into service. I had a car. It was a company car, a finance company. And I went to a meeting one day, and they said, has anybody here got a car? I put up my hand. They said, you go and represent our group. And I did. Before I went, they said to me, here's the motion. We want you to make a motion, and here it is. And they said, I wrote it out. And it happened to be a motion that Saskatchewan, where I was living then, adopt the General Service Conference Plan.
I didn't know it, but I was walking into a real political hotbed. The people that were running the service thing then, they didn't want to change it. They didn't want elections. Anyway, I went and I made the motion, and the chairman resigned and walked out of the room, and because I made the motion, they decided I knew something and made me chairman. I was the first chairman of the General Service Conference Committee in Saskatchewan, and that happened at the first service meeting I ever went to in my life. They made my sponsor delegate. Now, I want you to know that after 2 years of being chairman, it was obvious to me that I was the most qualified person to be the next delegate. But those stupid drunks, they voted me down. And they hurt my feelings. I went away to lick my wounds, and I was never going to do it again. And one day I didn't want to be delegate, and they elected me delegate. Well, I served as delegate, and I served as chairman, and I served as every other job, and then I resigned and went back and retired. Didn't resign, I retired. I went back, I'd done all my work and was going to be comfortable, and one night they phoned me up and they said, "We'd like to nominate you as a trustee nominee. Would you be willing to run?" And I said, "I'll do anything you want me to, but I'm not running for anything." And I forgot all about it. One day the phone rang, and it was a guy from New York, and he said, "You've been elected a trustee." Well, my sponsor was running, and I defeated him. I was a hell of a mess. I phoned him up and told him, "You lost." And he didn't like that too much. He said a few mean things to me. It took him a while. I had to go to New York the next year and buy a bunch of votes to get him elected, but in any event, I wound up a trustee through no fault of my own. Now, they had to pick a guy to be on the World Service Committee, and it had to be somebody that had 4 years, and he had to be a Canadian, and I was the only one. I didn't tell the folk back home that that's how I got. I went back and told them what a great job I was doing, but that's how I got to be on World Service. I was the only one there. And I was able to go to meetings with people from all over the world. And I went to Finland and participated in a World Service meeting there. My life just never been the same since. Because I got a view of Alcoholics Anonymous that is just incredible. When the book says that this program is indescribably wonderful, that's what it is. You can't describe it. You can't describe Alcoholics Anonymous. That's been part of my experience. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I couldn't get a job. I've never had to look for a job since I came here. I've been fired in my lifetime by just about every job I ever had I got fired from, and I know just about every way there is to fire somebody. You know, I knew in advance what kind of a guy this guy was. Some of them say, "This is going to hurt you more than it's going to hurt me," and that's a bunch of bull. There's no nice way to get fired. And they say, "Give us the keys to the company car." And when they're real nice, they say, "You're not really cut out for our business." Well, I've gone through all that, and I haven't had to do that since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I've never had to look for a job. And I've had more than my share of wonderful things. Every need that I've had has been met. And many wants. And sometimes I have to say to myself, that's not a need, that's a want. You can wait for that. You don't need it. I've traveled many miles and seen many things. I'd like to tell you that life is good. Life isn't always good. That was said here before this weekend. We had two children, boy and a girl. I just talked to the girl before the meeting. I phoned her, She's a mother now, and I'm a grandfather. Her husband's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He joined in the spring of this year, and he's still sober and doing great. My biggest job with him is stay out of his role. Let him do it his own way. They have a little boy that's my grandson. I say to him, "Kitty, who loves you?" And he says, "Grandpa." And I say, "Who loves Grandpa?" And he says, "Kaylee." And we have a beautiful relationship. Well, my wife and I had two children, and because we lived away from our family, we grew real close, and our home was always open and full of drunks. You know, it was beautiful because if I had to do something on a Saturday, if I had to go cut the grass, I knew that I could depend on somebody to come around, interrupt me, and have a cup of coffee. And I never had to worry about volunteering to do any work because I knew I'd never get it done. And there was always people. And we met in people's homes, and we shared and enjoyed, and our kids always participated. Our group always had a kids' party, and we used to have picnics, and the kids always participated. If somebody came to our house that wasn't a member of AA, he was just nothing. The kids disappeared. But if he was a member of AA, they'd sit around and talk, and they got to know everybody, and they called everybody the same as we did. Like, they never called Ed Serby, Mr. Serby, it was old Ed. And Dave Murray was old Dave. And that's the way they talked to him. They'd say, "Dad, here comes old Dave." I'd look and old Dave would be coming on. After we moved to Winnipeg, my sister was a great one for having family reunions, and she used to want to get all the family for a great big dinner, and the kids wouldn't go. We'd stay home. Our door was open, but we'd stay home. When my daughter got married, she said, "Dad, no matter where I go, I'll always be home for Christmas." One time a gal said to me, "What are you doing for Christmas?" I said, "We just sit around and love each other." And that's the way it was in our home. And so it was a terrible thing when I sat in the doctor's office one day and he told me our son had cancer. The little gal was 18. And he was in university. And I remember the day he graduated from high school, and he and I had a deal. His birthday was the 29th of May, and I never bought him birthday presents. We used to go shopping. And he'd just pick out anything he wanted, and he and I'd go, we'd go and look, and he'd say, "I'd like that," and we'd buy it. And on that 29th of May that year, we went shopping for his graduation, and he wanted new clothes, and we went and we bought new clothes, and we got all dressed up. And we looked all over because he wanted a pair of white shoes, and we got a new suit and a three-piece suit for him, and white slacks and white shoes. And I watched him at his graduation, and I thought, man, he's got it made. He had his own car, and it was all decorated. He had a beautiful girlfriend, and, well, a few months later, little Gary had cancer. And the doctor told me that day, "We're fighting for his life right now." And so, within 2 weeks, he had a leg amputated. He learned how to walk again. He learned how to walk on a prosthesis. And he learned how to dance, and he learned how to die. I was trying to teach him how to live, and he taught me how to die. One night he came home, and he said to me, "If there was a time machine that would take me back to what I was, I wouldn't take it. Because I have learned to believe in a God of my own understanding. I can go to my room at night and pray to him. I know that there's a purpose behind this whole thing, and it's going to be all right." Well, Gary went through three terrible lung operations, and in December 1974 he died. Before he died, he bought me a medallion. There's a lady in this room that has a medallion that is exactly the same. I saw it today. On one side he had the word Dad, and on the other side he had the words engraved, "Thanks for being here." I could not support that boy when I was drinking. He spent the first 2 years of my sobriety living with my sister. I was a hopeless, helpless drunk, and there was a young man who grew to be a giant, who said to me, "Thanks for being here." And that happened because of you people at Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can never express my gratitude. Many people said to me, "Did you ever think of taking a drink?" I was never so glad to be sober. Because you see, over the years he had heard me get up at night. He had heard the phone ring, and he really didn't bother me. He used to be able to phone me from the hospital, and I'd go over and we'd sit and talk. The nurse would say to him, "Gary, don't bother your dad, it's 4 o'clock in the morning," and he used to say, "He won't mind," and he knew I didn't. I could get up and slip over that hospital, and we'd sit and talk this thing out. Well, that changed our lives. Our family came apart, but it came back together again, because each person shares their own grief. Each person in that family had to work it out themselves, and we did. 2 years later, I sat in our living room, and my daughter had come over for dinner, and I thought maybe she'd had a tip with her husband or something, or maybe she's just bumming a meal. And after dinner, we went in to have our coffee in the living room, and my wife said to me, "We've got something to tell you." And telling you is the worst thing about the whole deal, because she said, "I've got cancer." I knew she had had some tests taken, and she'd got the results that day. Well, Nora went in the hospital, and she had an operation, and so far she's okay. And she's done real well. And this January, I sat in the doctor's office, and he said to me, "You've got cancer." And he didn't want to tell me. And I said to him, "Doctor, it's no big deal. Because I've had everything that you can have in life, and nobody owes me a thing. And we'll just leave the results of this deal where they're supposed to be." And I said to him, "Where do we go from here?" And he said, "Well, we get a surgeon." And I said, "Okay, you get a surgeon and line it up, and I've got to go to Montreal. I'll be back. And I'll see you on Friday, and we'll see where we go from here." Well, I had an operation, and I got a 50-50 chance, he tells me. Well, I don't pay much attention to statistics. I think I'll be here as long as God wants me to be. And I'm not too concerned about it, because I'm living real well. And if it was tomorrow, it wouldn't bother me. But see, I know that this thing cannot end in one lifetime. I know that when we thank Alcoholics Anonymous for our lives, we're talking about eternity. I know that as sure as I stand here tonight, I'll walk with that boy again. I know this thing is too big to end in one life. I know that the purpose is too great to be fulfilled in that short a period of time. I know that it will never end. I don't know that because of faith. I know that because of a certain knowledge. I know that, and I believe it as truly as I stand here. I fear not. I'm not afraid of life, I'm not afraid of death. That's been taken away from me. I walk in this world a free man. I'm free from resentment and anger and fear and all of those things as much as I want to be. And I choose to be. Some time ago, a minister described that freedom. We have the choice. And a man who was suffering a great pain wrote a little poem about it. He said, it matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishment the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. Each of us has that choice. We can choose the God experiment, or we can choose to walk alone. When I was a little boy, I used to go to church with my grandmother. My grandmother was an original Methodist at one time. We had a union in Canada. Presbyterians and Methodists got together, and some of the old timers let go hard. My in-laws were Presbyterians. My mother-in-law likes to tell me at times that that church I belong to is not really our church. Still belongs to them. I tell her, well, that's fine. You own it, we'll use it. But she's a great old gal. We love each other. I used to go with my grandmother, and it was always such a beautiful experience. She was a gracious lady. We had our own pew in church, and we used to be the first ones there and the last ones to leave, and it was like an AA meeting. She shook hands with everybody, and she used to take such care. She used to always pick a little bouquet of Lily of the Valley and put it on her coat. I loved her dearly. I lived to attend her 90th, or she lived to be 90, and I was sober attending her birthday and 90th birthday, and she knew I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was 16, she gave me a little autograph book, and in those days we used to give these autograph books and take them around to special people and have them write verses in them. Somehow over the years I kept that autograph book, and not long ago I found it, and just about that time, little Niles that we talked about had written a book, Dr. Bob and the Old Timer. If you haven't read that book, read it. It's a beautiful book. Niles and I had walked a few miles in this program together and got to be friends. And as a matter of fact, we'd gone to dinner together not too many months before we both got sick. I guess we both had cancer at the time. Niles died. Before he died, he wrote me a letter. In the letter, he said, we have done some good together, my friend. And I thought back to this autograph book, to the little note that my grandmother had written. The verse she had written was this, and I'd like to close with it. She said, do good and let who will be clever. Do noble deeds, not dream them all day long. And so make life, death, and the vast forever one grand sweet song. Thank you very much.